Chapter 9. With therapies like this, who needs disease? Cheryl Nagel's dream was on the verge of becoming tangible reality in late October of 1990. She and her husband Steve had wanted a child of their own for a long time. Now her flight was arriving deep in the heart of Eastern Europe, Romania. Steve could not take the time off, so her mother accompanied Cheryl to the remote city of Timișoara. Cheryl felt out of place, having traveled so far from her suburban home just outside Minneapolis. Back home, Steve cooked for a restaurant while she worked as a realtor's assistant. But when they heard the news of turbulence in that country and then of the orphanages full of desperate children, the Nagels knew where they had to go. Arriving turned out to be the easy part. Touring the surrounding area, Cheryl and her mother soon met Lindsay, a baby girl only several days old. She'd been born in the small coal mining town of Petrosani, nestled deep in the Transylvanian Alps. She had been given up by her impoverished mother, who was already burdened by caring for three older daughters. But Cheryl found the adoption process absurdly difficult, considering the desperate economic and social condition of the country. Constant shortages of the littlest things, even light bulbs, could cause delays, and a phone call overseas took 4 hours to connect before she could hear the reassuring sound of her husband's voice. After 2 weeks of paperwork, bureaucratic stalling, and struggling with a strange language, Cheryl returned to the United States to recoup her energy. Returning to Romania within a few weeks, however, she overcame the final hurdles and retrieved the 2-month-old baby. Lindsay was a happy, healthy child, her slightly small size reflecting the norms for her original family. The Nagels took her for a complete checkup with a clinic near Minneapolis. The doctor's battery of tests included one for HIV. To everyone's astonishment, Lindsay was confirmed positive. Upon investigation, the Nagels discovered that Lindsay's birth mother did not have the virus. This left only one possible source, the blood transfusion Lindsay had received, despite having had nothing more than a brief ear infection, in Romania's backward medical system, where the method was carelessly used as a treatment for almost any illness. Lindsay still seemed a picture of health. However, the Nagels were now told she had the deadly AIDS virus. Then the nightmare began. Steve and Cheryl agreed to treat Lindsay prophylactically, that is, to delay the onset of symptoms as long as possible. They were referred to a specialist at the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis, where the doctor examined Lindsay and found no symptoms at all. No infections, no abnormalities, nothing. "She is a very bright, smiling, and happy girl," noted the doctor, who nevertheless decided to head off a potential AIDS pneumonia immediately. Lindsay was prescribed Ceftra to be taken 3 times each week. The drug is known by dozens of brand names, including Bactrim. Ceftra is a sulfa drug, a remnant of the era before penicillin and other antibiotics. Sulfa drugs do not target invading microbes as narrowly as the antibiotics and so have become notorious for their side effects. According to the physician's desk reference, Ceftra can cause nausea, vomiting, anorexia, and bone marrow depression, and also includes rash, fever, and leukopenia among its side effects. Even the drug manufacturer's Burroughs Wellcome strongly recommends against using Ceftra for more than 2 weeks in children or adults. Young Lindsay, however, would take the drug for some 9 months. When the Nagels brought their daughter back a week later, the specialist announced that Lindsay's T-cell count was perfectly normal, nor had any infections shown up. But given the HIV infection, the doctor wanted to slow the presumably inevitable appearance of AIDS. This time, she prescribed the only drug approved for AIDS therapy, AZT, a chemotherapeutic drug designed to kill growing cells. Lindsay began swallowing a total of 120 milligrams of the drug every single day in addition to her Ceftra. AZT stands for azidothymidine, a drug often marketed under the names zidovudine or Retrovir. As with Ceftra, AZT is produced by the pharmaceutical giant Burroughs Wellcome. Both drugs have toxic effects, but compared to the sulfa drug, AZT amounts to poison. The doctor herself admitted some of the effects in her medical report of the visit, stating that Lindsay's mother was explained the side effects of zidovudine, which are primarily bone marrow suppression with anemia, sometimes nausea and vomiting, and rarely the cause of other symptoms like skin rash. If anything, this understated the effects. AZT kills dividing cells anywhere in the body, causing ulcerations and hemorrhaging, damage to hair follicles and skin, killing mitochondria, the energy cells of the brain, wasting away of muscles, and the destruction of the immune system and other blood cells. Children are affected more severely because many more of their cells are growing than in adults. Amazingly, AZT was first approved for treatment of AIDS in 1987 and then for prevention of AIDS in 1990. Totally unaware of the toxicity of this controversial drug, the Nagels faithfully fed their daughter the AZT syrup four times a day. At their next visit the following month, the doctor strangely began praising Lindsay's improvement. Upon reflection, the Nagels grew puzzled. What improvement could the doctor have meant, since Lindsay had suffered no medical problems at all before the treatment began? In fact, their daughter was already changing for the worse. Despite gaining slightly in weight, she was beginning to fall behind the proper growth rate for her 5 months of age. She was also losing her appetite, feeling too sick to drink her milk. This process continued for months. Lindsay developed no infectious diseases, but her appetite continued to decline. The doctor acknowledged that the child was falling further behind the normal growth curve. By the time Lindsay reached her first birthday on October 15, 1991, her adoptive parents began to lose patience. The doctor seemed to believe the lack of growth had more to do with HIV infection than with any drug effects of Sceptre or AZT. As the Nagels began reading up on the officially recognized side effects of these drugs, their uneasiness turned to outright anxiety when they found perfect descriptions of their daughter's condition. Becoming suspicious of their doctor for not admitting or discussing these side effects, Steve and Cheryl took Lindsay to Dr. Margaret Hostetter at the University of Minnesota Clinic. They felt overwhelmed and wanted clearer advice. Dr. Hostetter possessed all the poise and confidence of her twin appointments as a university professor and director of the clinic's infectious disease program. Exuding an urbane but authoritative charm, she at first appeared much more professional and much friendlier than the other physicians. "Thank you for referring this lovely family to me," she wrote to Lindsay's first pediatrician after her November visit. Running a complete battery of tests, she decided to take Lindsay off the Sceptre immediately. But the Nagels did notice that the doctor seemed to blame Lindsay's weight loss on HIV rather than on drug side effects. As soon as the Sceptre prescription ended, Lindsay began rebounding. Within 1 month, her weight had again increased, though hardly back to normal, and her appetite recovered slightly. Amazingly, Dr. Hostetter completely missed the point. She had increased Lindsay's AZT dosage at the same time as ending the Sceptre, so at the Nagels' next visit, she credited the baby's improvement to the AZT. In fact, she discussed plans to increase the AZT yet again. Even the experimental drug DDL, another powerful drug similar to AZT and just approved by the FDA, started cropping up among the doctor's suggestions. After the rapid side effects of the sulfa drug had disappeared, the slower toxicity of the extra AZT began taking over. Lindsay stopped improving, and her weight, though still rising slowly, could no longer keep up with the normal growth rate for her age. She remained at the bottom end of the healthy weight range. By March, she virtually stopped growing altogether. Her parents, fending off an increasing nervousness with each passing month, nevertheless kept up the daily syrup feeding routine. The doctor praised Lindsay's non-existent progress at each visit. A few weeks later, the doctor had stretched the Nagels' patience by pressuring them to put Lindsay on DDL, a chemotherapy like AZT. The young girl's T-cell levels were dropping, she said, and new drugs might help combat the deadly HIV. Investigating for themselves, the Nagels discovered that all children normally start with more than 3,000 T-cells per microliter at birth, declining to about 1,000 before adulthood. Lindsay's counts were coming down near the standard healthy rate. Naturally, the Nagels refused DDL therapy, but now they were reconsidering AZT as well. The tension finally erupted a few days after Lindsay's second birthday on October 15, 1992. Steve and Cheryl woke up one night to the tormented screams of their daughter. Racing into her room, they found her sitting up and tearfully clutching her legs. The muscle pains were unbearable, leg massages, Tylenol, they used anything that would allow Lindsay to sleep again. The same thing happened the next evening, and the next one. Night after night, the pain returned with ruthless consistency to deprive the entire family of sleep for a whole month. The Nagels recognized precisely what was happening to their daughter. Based on their own study, they had already learned that AZT produces muscle wasting as one of its side effects. By chance, they stumbled across an article discussing Peter Duisberg's dissent against AZT treatment for AIDS. Upon tracking down his phone number and calling, they received an earful about the drug's toxic effects. From there, the Nagels talked with several other scientists dissenting against the HIV hypothesis. By early November, the picture had become clear. The day they received a letter from Duisberg with scientific documents on AZT and on the shaky evidence for an AIDS virus, the Nagels stopped feeding their daughter the drug. Lindsay's changes took even her parents by surprise. After Lindsay was off AZT, she became a new child almost overnight. She started sleeping much better, including longer hours. Her muscle cramps went away. She started eating at least 2 to 3 times as much every day as she had ever eaten before. She would now drink milk, and especially around other youngsters, would drink as much as 6 ounces at a time. She would never drink milk before unless we added chocolate syrup, not a very nutritious drink. She displayed a much calmer demeanor. Lindsay was described almost as hyperactive by several people, including maternal grandparents who babysat a lot. This was a night and day difference. Lindsay before could not sit still for 5 minutes and was seemingly agitated all the time. After seeing our nutritionist for only 2 months and ridding Lindsay's body of toxic effects of being on AZT and Septra, Lindsay now, at 27 months, had an upswing on the chart. Her weight has been going up ever since. Now, for the first time in 21 months, Lindsay is at 24 pounds and is back on the chart at the Loth percentile. Dr. Hostetter knew nothing about Lindsay's being off AZT. The Nagels contacted the physician to demand an open discussion about the drug's merits at their next visit to take place in early December of 1992. They were caught completely off guard by the doctor's reaction. Dr. Hostetter looked very tense. "We were verbally attacked as if we were 5-year-olds, and how dare we question her opinion, let alone the use of AZT. She told us how lucky we were that Lindsay had tolerated AZT so well and had not needed to go on DDL up until now." Then Dr. Hostetter drew a large diagram on the blackboard and told us, as she reminded us that she had told us all of this before, which cells AZT affects and which ones it definitely does not affect. "If one of AZT's main side effects is bone marrow toxicity, how does a doctor know which cells the AZT will affect? How does the AZT know?" After our lecture, Dr. Hostetter gave us her 20-minute sales pitch for AZT. The parents felt too intimidated by the meeting to let the doctor know they had ended the AZT treatment. In a letter written 1 week afterward to the Nagels' private physician, Hostetter noted that Lindsay had grown remarkably well during the previous 2 months and warned that, "We unfortunately might well see a return of Lindsay's previous failure to thrive were we to discontinue this drug." When the Nagels finally informed the doctor in writing and switched Lindsay to a chiropractor and nutritionist, Hostetter's mood turned downright ugly. Her response letter thundered a stream of dire warnings. "As we have discussed repeatedly, AIDS is a fatal disease. To take Lindsay off Retrovir now will, I am afraid, hasten her decline and death. As parents, you are responsible for your child's health and life. Running away from qualified medical care will not help you, and it will certainly jeopardize Lindsay's life. You must take Lindsay to a qualified MD immediately." Hostetter followed up the letter with an angry call to the Nagels' chiropractor on New Year's Eve. "She wanted to warn our chiropractor that she had no right to be seeing Lindsay," recalled Cheryl. "She also said that there are foster homes to provide care for children who were in Lindsay's predicament, living with parents who wouldn't give their daughter AZT. Hoping to stall Dr. Hostetter and to get a second opinion, the Nagels took their adopted daughter to another physician referred by Hostetter, but all he gave them was the same opinion. He recommended they restore Lindsay's treatment, and his nurse practitioner called AZT a wonder drug, a term even its manufacturer Burroughs Wellcome has never dared use. Lindsay remains off AZT and all other toxic drugs. Her healthy growth pattern continues, she suffers no unusual diseases, and she is developing normally. 2 years after suffering from AZT-induced leg cramps in 1994, she became a budding star in a local ballet school. And on October 15th, 1995, Lindsay celebrated her 5th birthday with HIV and without AZT in excellent health. According to public health officials, she should already have died of AIDS because babies with HIV are supposed to survive only about 2 years. Not everyone is so fortunate. In 1987, 3 years before Lindsay was born in faraway Romania, Doug and Nancy Simon brought their daughter Candace into the world in a town south of Minneapolis. Their daughter certainly seemed healthy enough, but by the time she reached 1.5 years of age, the doctor discovered she had antibodies against HIV. Investigation traced the infection to her mother, who had contracted the virus from her husband. He, in turn, had contracted it from a blood transfusion several years earlier. None of them suffered from AIDS. The Simons took Candace to the Minneapolis Children's Hospital, the same one where Lindsay Nagel would be given Sceptra and AZT a couple of years later. Candace, too, became a victim of AIDS medicine. Doctors there prescribed interferon, a powerful anti-metabolic drug that shuts down cell function. They later added AZT to her regimen, a treatment that, unlike in Lindsay's case, would last 3.5 years. The constant testing added to the parent's sense of being overwhelmed. X-rays, blood samples, brain scans. For a while, Candace appeared to handle the therapy without too many problems. Then her condition took a nosedive. Her appetite declined to dangerously low levels. The hospital became almost a second home, and by late 1992, she could no longer leave her bed. A new symptom, hauntingly reminiscent of Lindsay's AZT poisoning, took effect. When the pain hit, she would double over in her bed like a safety pin, and wild-eyed, grabbed her ankles until it eased. Soon the doctors found malignant cancer spreading tumors throughout her stomach area. For the pain, they prescribed morphine, then surgically cut the nerves to her intestines. Candace could no longer eat on her own, and the doctors began feeding her directly to her blood through intravenous tubes. Though 5 years old, she had lost control of her intestines and had to wear diapers. In June of 1993, only 3 days before she turned 6 years old, Candace died painfully. Nearby, Lindsay Nagel had already stopped AZT 7 months earlier and was recovering her health spectacularly. But Candace continued the drug right up to the end. Now both her parents take AZT as well. The Nagels know of the Simons' situation and consider themselves lucky for not having followed through on their daughter's AZT treatment. The death and resurrection of AZT. The virus hunters have always aspired to the glories of their predecessors, the bacteria hunters. Medicine still takes credit for eliminating bacterial diseases with antibiotics such as penicillin. These drugs attacked their bacterial targets with tremendous specificity, meaning they did little direct damage to the host's body. Antibiotics became known as the magic bullet for bacterial infections. Fire them into the body and kill only invading bacteria. But for viruses, the problem was different. These are non-living microbes made of proteins, DNA or RNA, and sometimes even a tiny membrane molecules all made entirely by human cells inside a human body. How could any drug possibly discriminate between the production of proteins and DNA made for viruses and those made for their human hosts? Despite never-ending searches for magic bullets against viruses, the efforts have produced little but failure. In principle, an antiviral drug may never be possible. The only solution offered has been vaccination, which prevents viruses from entering cells. The 1975 Nobel Prize for Medicine awarded for Howard Temin's discovery of the protein reverse transcriptase popularized this unique retrovirus enzyme. Many virus hunters switched into chasing retroviruses, and the reverse transcriptase protein took on mythic proportions. It did, after all, copy the virus genetic information from RNA molecules backward into DNA, this new copy integrating somewhere into the genetic DNA structure of the infected cell. Normally, the cell keeps its genetic material in DNA, copying selected genes into RNA as needed. This reverse feature of the retrovirus protein inspired virus hunters to make it their key target for magic bullet drugs. At least in diseases caused by retroviruses, they speculated, some effective drug could be found. Once AIDS was blamed on HIV, a retrovirus, the race was on to find a drug that could inhibit the viral reverse transcriptase. Drug development since World War II had also been heavily shaped by cancer research. Cancer, too, fueled ambitions among doctors to find magic bullets that could destroy the cancer tissue without killing the host. First came surgery, the attempt simply to cut out the tumor. This method has serious limitations. Radiation also became popular, based on the hope that tumors could be burned away by X-rays or other high-energy beams before destroying the body. But radiation therapy has mostly proved disappointing. Chemotherapy using powerful cell-killing drugs came into vogue during the 1950s. Starting in World War I, researchers observed the destruction of blood cells by mustard gas, the chemical warfare agent used to hideous effect in the trenches of Europe's battlefields. A few attempts to use this drug against cancer turned up with minimal results, largely because mustard gas was so toxic to the patient. Shortly after James Shannon took over the NIH in 1955, he instituted several major research programs to attract vast new budgets from Congress. The largest of these became the Virus Cancer Program, which ultimately converted itself into the War on AIDS. The second largest project aimed to develop chemotherapy agents to treat cancer. The 1950s and 1960s, therefore, saw a proliferation of drugs designed to kill growing cells. At first, the goal seemed straightforward. Since cancer is made of persistently dividing cells, find a drug that prefers to kill cells that grow. The biggest problem with this concept lay in the body's own tissues, many of which replenish themselves constantly with rapidly growing cells. Therefore, cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy experience devastating side effects, including hair loss, muscle wasting, severe weight loss due to intoxication of the intestines and benign intestinal microbes, anemia and the need for blood transfusions, and destruction of the immune system, composed mostly of white blood cells. Decades before the appearance of AIDS, chemotherapy patients often died of the same pneumocystis carinii pneumonia that later killed young homosexual men. AZT was invented under this program in 1964. Jerome Horowitz, heading a lab at the Detroit Cancer Foundation and financed with an NIH grant, created a chemically modified form of a DNA building block. Every time a cell divides, it must copy its complete genetic code, allowing one copy for each new cell. Genetic information is stored as a sequence of four letters in long chains of DNA, known as chromosomes. Each building block of DNA is linked to the one before it, almost like train cars. But Horowitz's altered DNA building block, azidothymidine, AZT, surreptitiously enters the growing DNA chain while a cell is preparing to divide and acts as a premature caboose, blocking further DNA building blocks from being added. In short, the cell cannot copy its DNA sequence and dies trying. AZT was the perfect killer of dividing cells. However, when he tested the compound on cancer-ridden mice, it failed to cure the cancer. Horowitz was so disappointed he never bothered publishing the experiment and eventually abandoned that line of research. The drug must have killed the tumors which contained dividing cells, but it so effectively destroyed healthy growing tissues that the mice died of the extreme toxicity. The drug was shelved and no patent was ever filed. Human DNA is a string of 109 A, T, C, and Gs linked in a specific sequence. A. Normal DNA synthesis. B. DNA synthesis with the T analog AZT. Each of the four building blocks, nucleotides of human DNA, has two links. But AZT, an analog of the nucleotide T, has only one link. Therefore, it stops DNA synthesis and kills the cell. 20 years later, Gallo's 1984 press conference announcing HIV as the AIDS virus set in motion a new hunt, this time for a magic bullet drug to act against the virus. The federal government had promised treatment, and it had to deliver. Some virus hunters, including Jonas Salk, scurried to invent an HIV vaccine. Others searched for an antiviral drug and turned to the cancer chemotherapy program for already developed chemicals. The fastest way to put a drug to market would be to select one that had finished some testing in the past. Burroughs Wellcome became the pharmaceutical company positioned at the right place and the right time. One of the giants in the industry, the British-based company maintains a relatively unusual corporate structure as a mostly non-profit charitable institution. Most of its profits are paid not to stockholders, but as grants and donations to biomedical research institutions. By throwing so much money around, Burroughs Wellcome has bought enormous influence throughout government and universities, especially through its American branch. A large number of scientists and physicians had developed informal ties to the company, having been paid to test its pharmaceuticals many times over the years. The company's head researcher in the United States, David Barry, recognized the opportunity after Gallo's press conference. Barry knew his way around the federal bureaucracy in getting a drug approved. He had originally worked at the FDA during the 1970s as a virologist. His research had focused on the flu viruses, and he occasionally dabbled in retroviruses after they became popular. Upon switching to Burroughs' welcome, he paid more attention to herpes viruses, also a hot research item. He brought to his new job a vast network of connections with fellow virus hunters and top FDA people. Upon hearing the official call for anti-HIV drugs, Barry turned to the company shelves for previously rejected substances. If one of these could be approved, the company would save vast sums of research and development money. The political pressure for a quick solution played in his favor. The key lay in winning FDA approval, which counted for more than mere permission to sell. The agency bans most potential drugs, automatically suppressing the competition and granting treatment monopolies for approved drugs. This monopoly alone can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the pharmaceutical company holding the patent. Back in the days when snake oil could freely be sold as a nostrum, drugs would sell only according to the reputation of the producer and their effectiveness against disease. Now the public depends on and trusts FDA screening procedures. Barry selected a handful of drugs and quietly forwarded them to a couple of Burroughs Wellcome's former collaborators. One of them was Danny Bolognese, a veteran retrovirus hunter and professor at North Carolina's Duke University, who not only knew Barry, but also was so close to Gallo, he belonged to the Bob Club. Bolognese tested the substances in his laboratory, checking whether they would prevent HIV from multiplying while infecting cells in the test tube. One of the drugs clearly proved most potent against the virus compound S, as it was codenamed. Its real name was AZT. Bolognese then referred Barry to Sam Broder, the man in charge of Gallo's laboratory at the National Cancer Institute. Broder had joined the NIH in the early 1970s, just as Gallo's star was beginning to rise. Broder made his career testing and developing cancer chemotherapy, but he also allied himself to Gallo and thereby practiced a bit of virus hunting himself, soon becoming a full member of the Bob Club. Politically savvy, he could see by the early 1980s that the time had come to switch his emphasis from cancer to AIDS, and immediately after Gallo's press conference, he mobilized NIH researchers to find a drug. According to Bruce Nussbaum, the hallmark of Broder's operation was simple. Find a drug that had been tested for a previous disease, make sure it had a big corporate sugar daddy behind it, push the bureaucracy like hell to move it along, and talk it up. Talk it up. Broder's tenacity made him a perfect advocate for AZT. Barry realized that Broder, if properly recruited, would aggressively push through the bureaucracy to get AZT approved. So Barry sent Compound S to Broder late in 1984, who discovered its powerful effect on HIV and waxed enthusiastic. Broder was so completely hooked he soon became known as Mr. AZT. Barry, Broder, and Bolognese together published their laboratory experiments on AZT. They reported that only a tiny concentration was needed to block the virus from multiplying. Of course, this would mean nothing if the same dose of AZT would also kill the T cells in which the virus grew, in which case it would destroy the immune system before the virus supposedly could. Further tests gave an answer that sounded too good to be true. At least 1,000 times as much AZT was needed to kill the T cells as to stop the virus. This theoretically meant doctors could use small doses of the drug to stop HIV without seriously damaging their patients' immune systems. No one bothered to check this fantastic result. The Burroughs Wellcome and NIH researchers somehow had to explain their success, and they billed AZT as a compound that specifically attacked reverse transcriptase, the retrovirus enzyme. In other words, they quickly declared they had finally found a magic bullet. AZT, however, did not really attack reverse transcriptase directly. It only did what it had been designed to do originally, stop the synthesis of DNA. Since the reverse transcriptase copies retroviral genes into DNA, the drug certainly interfered with its normal function. But the infected T cell, meanwhile, produces its own DNA. Every time the cell divides, it must copy 100,000 times more DNA than the small virus, giving AZT 100,000 chances to kill the cell for every opportunity to block the virus. Since retroviruses can make viral DNA only in cells making their own DNA, the drug could not possibly attack the virus without also killing the cell, casting suspicion on the Bolognese-Broder experiments. Recent studies conducted by smaller laboratories have tested AZT on other samples of T cells, finding that the same low concentration that stops HIV also kills the cells. According to these studies, the real cell-killing dose is 1,000 times lower than that reported by Broder, Berry, and Bolognese. AZT is definitely toxic, indiscriminately killing virus-infected and uninfected T cells alike. Broder and his collaborators have never corrected their original reports, nor have they explained the huge discrepancies between their data and other papers. To this date, the Physician's Desk reference quotes the low toxicity of AZT reported by Broder, Berry, Bolognese, and colleagues in 1986, although the real toxicity of the drug is 1,000 times higher, according to more than 6 independent studies published since. They also overlooked 2 even more fundamental problems with their lab experiment. 1, the virus against which Broder and colleagues tested AZT was actively growing in the test tube. But in the body of an infected person, antibodies neutralize HIV years before AIDS appears, if it comes at all. In persons with antibody against HIV, the virus is inactive, not making any viral DNA at all. Thus, AZT in a human being cannot attack the virus anyway, for it has already become dormant. It can attack only growing human cells. 2. AZT, like all other chemotherapeutic drugs, is unable to distinguish an HIV-infective cell from one that is uninfected. This has disastrous consequences on AZT-treated people, since only 1 in about 500 T cells of HIV antibody-positive persons is ever infected. AZT must kill 499 good T cells to kill just 1 that is infected by the hypothetical AIDS virus. This is called a very bad therapeutic index in pharmacology. It is a tragedy for people who already suffer from a T cell deficiency. A toxic chemotherapy was about to be unleashed on AIDS victims, but no one had the time to think twice about its potential to destroy the immune systems of people who might otherwise survive. The pressure was on to find a drug. Berry used this as leverage when he began quiet negotiations with key FDA officials, arguing that AZT should be rushed through the approval process with reduced testing requirements. Broder was doing his bit, championing the drug through every channel of NIH power at his disposal. FDA officials relented and agreed to help the drug through in order to save time. Given the toxicity of AZT, Burroughs Wellcome would need every break it could get to win approval. Berry and Broder were the right team to get that break. Says Nussbaum in Good Intentions, David Berry was the puppet master, and his favorite marionette was Sam Broder. While Broder was charging around promoting AZT at the National Institutes of Health, Berry was working quietly behind the scenes, orchestrating a whole panoply of actors who would ensure the drug's ultimate commercial success. Broder rushed AZT through its Phase 1 trials, the test to determine its toxicity in humans. FDA cooperation allowed him to cut corners, making the drug appear to have minimal side effects. Now they were ready for the Phase 2 study to see whether the drug would actually fight AIDS symptoms. The AZT cover-up. Double-blind placebo-controlled studies form one of the cornerstones of medical science. This rigorous gold standard puts any promising new treatment to the ultimate test. When applied to humans, does it really work? If properly structured, such a study throws out the prejudices of the researchers and yields the bottom line. A group of people with the appropriate disease is carefully selected, then secretly divided into 2 subgroups matched for every important characteristic. To test a therapy for tuberculosis, for example, both groups would contain the same number of tuberculosis patients. One group is given the treatment, the other a placebo, a sugar pill, meaning a sham treatment that appears identical to the therapy itself. This removes any interfering effect of patient psychology or actions. And the study is conducted in a double-blind fashion, so that neither the patients nor the doctors know who is receiving treatment and who gets placebo until the experiment is finished. Under normal circumstances, AZT's Phase 2 trial would have been such a double-blind, placebo-controlled study. But the intense political pressure to approve an AIDS drug, enhanced by fast-spreading rumors in the homosexual community of AZT's powerful benefits, forced FDA officials to take shortcuts. Although the study was finally published as if it had been a double-blind, placebo-controlled test, it most definitely was not. The drug's toxicity inevitably unblinded the study within weeks, its effects on patients being painfully obvious. David Berry structured the entire study from beginning to end. He tapped Burroughs Wellcome's informal network of scientific collaborators, selecting 12 medical centers around the country for participation. By providing $10,000 per study patient to each clinic involved, he induced a whopping 51 researchers to jump on board, a group heavily weighted with old virus-hunting peers of Berry's. Just having that many well-connected medical scientists helped swing the political balance in his favor, and it locked in their own loyalties to AZT. Even Michael Gottlieb, who reported the first 5 AIDS cases, joined in. There was hardly a medical institution left in the country that was not involved and that could have offered an independent second opinion. Berry chose Margaret Fischel, a virologist at the University of Miami, to head the experiment. Thus, Burroughs Wellcome not only co-authored Drucker, Nussenhoff, Lehrman, Segretti, Rogers, Berry, but also paid for the licensing study of its own product. But nobody seemed to mind this blatant conflict of interest, not the many non-Burroughs Wellcome researchers on the study, not the NIH, which co-sponsored the study, not the FDA, not the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, which published the study. A total of 282 AIDS patients was recruited, roughly half being put on AZT and the other half receiving the placebo. The trial conducted in 1986 was scheduled to treat each patient for 6 months. After 4 months, the announced results seemed stupendous, so amazing in fact that the study had to be aborted early. Fischel and her associates decided they could not ethically continue to withhold such a wonderful drug from the placebo group. 19 placebo recipients had died during the study compared to only one member of the AZT group. 45 in the placebo group developed opportunistic AIDS diseases versus only 24 in the AZT group. And while the T-cell counts of the placebo patients continued to decline, the AZT group saw a temporary surge in their T-cells. Results like these could propel almost any drug to FDA approval. But even an inspection of the officially published data reveals some grim problems. The study does not indicate that Fischel and colleagues sorted their patients according to use of such recreational drugs as heroin or poppers. Since most were homosexual men, this could complicate matters if, for example, the placebo group contained more heavy drug users. Fischel herself also admitted that an undocumented number of the patients were allowed to take other medical drugs during the study, a factor that introduced another wild card. When pioneer AIDS researcher Joseph Sonnabend from New York first read the AZT study report, he had a lot of questions, but the first one had nothing to do with AZT. Why had so many placebo patients died? I was suspicious of the study from the beginning because the mortality rate was simply unacceptable, he said. My patients were simply not dying in those sort of numbers that rapidly. Sonnabend had an added difficulty. The causes of death provided to the FDA did not match those in the research Fischel had written for the New England Journal of Medicine. Sloppy research, Sonnabend said. Still, taking the results at face value, a shocking picture of AZT toxicity emerges. 66 AZT recipients suffered severe nausea, a category that would have been mentioned only if this was clinically serious, as compared to 25 in the placebo group. All AZT users saw their muscles waste away, while only 3 placebo recipients suffered this symptom. And a full 30 in the AZT group survived only with multiple blood transfusions to replace their poison blood cells, compared to 5 similar cases among the placebo users. The less publicized side effects of AZT more than abolished its presumed benefits. A follow-up study on those same patients found that Fischel's neat picture mysteriously vanished once everyone was put on AZT. Within months, the death rate of the original AZT test group rapidly caught up to the former placebo group. After a year, 1/3 of both groups had died. Fischel, the queen of AZT, and her co-workers shrugged off these new results, suggesting that AZT's miraculous effects somehow wore off after a few months. Or perhaps the benefits never existed in the first place. A flood of previously concealed information has surfaced since the trial, all showing that it became unblinded from the start. The controls completely broke down. The doctors certainly found out quickly who took AZT and who did not, because AZT induces serious destruction of blood cells and the bone marrow that produces them. Bruce Nussbaum, in his 1990 book Good Intentions, described the mood in the trial's first month. A move to stop the trial began immediately. The toxicity of AZT was proving to be extremely high, much higher than indicated by Sam Broder's previous safety trials. PIs, principal investigators, began to worry that AZT was killing bone marrow cells so fast that patients would quickly come down with aplastic anemia, a murderous disease. This was terrifying to many PIs. There was enormous pressure to stop, recalls Broder. People said, "My God, what's going on? We're getting these anemias. What's going on? We never saw this level of anemia before." For those doctors who may have missed AZT patients vomiting up blood, the routine blood tests gave away the secrets. Michael Lang was one of the researchers in the trial, interviewed for a 1992 British television documentary. "I don't think the trials were really blinded, because when you take AZT, your red blood cells increase in size. You can notice that on an ordinary blood count, and since blood counts were monitored and the information fed back to patients, this information was available to the investigators." The patients, needless to say, often found out what they were taking by such clues, but they had other methods. For one thing, the AZT and placebo pills tasted different at the study's beginning. When doctors finally caught some patients tasting each other's pills, they fixed the problem. This came too late, of course, for full damage control. The patients who missed this opportunity discovered other ways around the controls. According to Christopher Babick, an AIDS activist with People with AIDS Coalition, "During the Phase 2 trials, we received many phone calls in our office from individuals who wanted to determine whether or not they were using the placebo or actually receiving AZT. There were three laboratories in New York which would analyze the medication. We would refer individuals there. If, in fact, they were on placebo, they would make arrangements to acquire the drug AZT. Oftentimes, they would share it with individuals who were in the trials, thus really rendering the Phase 2 trials unblinded." The patients had bought the early rumors of AZT's incredible healing powers, and they really did not want to take a placebo. Some of the placebo group secretly did use AZT, explaining the presence of its toxic side effects among those patients. The AIDS activist group Project Inform, originally an opponent of AZT, tried to dislodge the trial's internal working papers to confirm that the placebo group members with toxicity symptoms had used AZT, despite invoking the Freedom of Information Act, they never could get the documents released. The trial's organizers pulled one final stunt to help AZT succeed. The original plan had called for each patient to participate for 6 months. But long before the 6-month double-blind placebo-controlled trial was over, the blinded researchers saw that the AZT group was doing better than the placebo group. How did they see this if the study was blinded? The researchers could monitor the tally of AZT versus placebo either by AZT's toxicity or by something else. As soon as the tally appeared to favor AZT over the placebo, the FDA Oversight Committee aborted the trial. Insisting they were acting on ethical considerations, the organizers immediately provided AZT to all patients. Patients spent an average of about 4 months in the original study, some less than 1 month. The final analysis included all patients with projected guesses to fill the gaps in the data. As the follow-up study later observed, the death rate among the original AZT group quickly caught up to the former placebo group. Had the trial not been unblinded, or had the FDA chosen to wait the full 6 months, the relative death rates would have looked radically different. In any case, Fischel's pretense of double-blind control smacks of dishonesty. Once the controls broke down, the study began to unravel. While some placebo recipients were actually taking AZT, some of the AZT recipients were being taken off the drug. Many of the patients simply could not tolerate AZT, and the physicians had to do something to save their lives. Drug therapy was temporarily discontinued, or the frequency of doses decreased if severe adverse reactions were noted, admitted Fischel in the fine print of her paper. The study medication was withdrawn if unacceptable toxic effects or a cancer-requiring therapy developed. This astonishing slip reveals that the doctors did indeed know who was using AZT. But never did Fischel tell how many AZT patients were taken off the drug, nor for how long. Other patients dropped out of the trial altogether. Some 15% of the AZT group disappeared, possibly including patients with the most severe toxic effects. Fischel and her collaborators never bothered accounting for the loss, fueling the suspicion that they could have even dropped the sickest patients themselves. This is a likelier possibility than it first sounds. Author John Lauritsen succeeded in obtaining documents released under the Freedom of Information Act and found many examples of incomplete or altered data. Causes of death were never verified, as by autopsy, and report forms often listed suspected reasons. Naturally, Fischel and colleagues tended to assume that diseases in the placebo group were AIDS-related, while assuming diseases in the AZT group were not. The symptom report forms looked even worse. Mysterious changes appeared, often weeks after the initial report for a given patient, including scratching out the original symptoms. The unexplained tamperings generally had no initials indicating approval by the head researcher. Other symptom reports were copied onto new forms, but often lacked the original form for comparison. And on some forms reporting toxic effects of AZT, the symptoms were crossed out months later. During the trial, an FDA visit to one of the test hospitals in Boston uncovered suspicious problems. The FDA inspector found multiple deviations from standard protocol procedure, an FDA official later commented, and she recommended that data from this center be excluded from the analysis of the multi-center trial. Months after the trial had finished, the FDA finally decided to inspect the other 11 centers. By then, much of the evidence had been lost in the confusion. Far too many patients had been affected by test rule violations, and the FDA ultimately chose to use all of the data, good or bad, including data from the Boston Center. One FDA official let the cat out of the bag on the hopeless mess. Whatever the real data may be, clearly patients in this study, both on AZT and placebo, reported many disease symptoms, possible adverse drug experiences. Other than allegedly reducing death, the Phase 2 trial made two other claims on behalf of AZT. Two, it raised the T-cell levels of immune-deficient AIDS patients and reduced the number of opportunistic infections they suffered. All testing violations aside, AZT can temporarily raise T-cell counts. So can various other poisons and even severe bleeding after a long period. When some tissue is attacked by a toxin or blood is lost due to an accident, the body tends to overcompensate for the loss by producing too many replacements, as long as it can. At some point, even the ability to replace white blood cells becomes overtaxed, and the T-cell counts collapse downward, exactly as observed in the Fischel study. A temporary increase in T-cells does not necessarily indicate the patient is improving. 2. AZT blocks DNA production, not only in human T-cells or retroviruses, but also in any bacteria that might exist in the body. Thus, it can act as an indiscriminate antibiotic, killing opportunistic infections while destroying the immune system. Even Burroughs Wellcome had previously billed the drug as an antibacterial. This effect could explain the lower number of such infections in the AZT group. But the effect lasts only a short time. Once the body's immune system is devastated by AZT, the microbes take over permanently. Ignoring all the chaos, the FDA approved the drug on the basis of this experiment. Apparently, the strategy of involving many medical researchers from many institutions had paid off. There was only one critical voice questioning a therapy that infiltrates a DNA chain terminator into human bodies indefinitely, the voice of the retired bacteriologist Seymour Cohen. The severe toxicity of AZT to bone marrow, as well as unexpected interactions of other drugs with AZT, indicate the importance of knowing more about the effects of the compound. We ask, therefore, which normal cells are severely damaged? Is the damage reversible or irreversible? Are the cells killed and the chromosomes fragmented, as one might expect from a termination of DNA chains? Are AZT and DDC mutagenic or possibly carcinogenic? These questions have not yet been answered to my knowledge. Several leading scientists, even virologists, also felt uneasy about the whole affair. But they preferred to remain silent or restricted their concerns to informal comments to the press. For example, Jay Levy at the University of California at San Francisco had been one of the first scientists to isolate HIV. A Newsday article described his comments on the drug. "I think AZT can only hasten the demise of the individual. It's an immune disease," he said, "and AZT only further harms an already decimated immune system." Even Jerome Groopman, one of the Phase 2 participating scientists, harbored serious reservations. The head of a research group at a prominent Boston hospital, he quickly discovered the effects of AZT on his patients. When Groupman gave it to 14 patients on a compassionate basis, only two were still able to take it after 3 months. "We found it nearly impossible to keep patients on the drug," Groupman says. Sam Broder, on the other hand, never seemed to entertain a second thought. When the Wright brothers took off in their first airplane, it probably would have been inappropriate to begin a discussion of airline safety, he nonchalantly told the Presidential HIV Commission in 1988. But Martin Delaney, founder and head of the AIDS activist group Project Inform, San Francisco, was furious. "The multi-center clinical trials of AZT are perhaps the sloppiest and most poorly controlled trials ever to serve as the basis for an FDA drug licensing approval. Because mortality was not an intended endpoint, causes of death were never verified. Despite this and a frightening record of toxicity, the FDA approved AZT in record time, granting a treatment, IND, investigational new drug, in less than 5 days and full pharmaceutical licensing in less than 6 months. David Berry had already negotiated behind closed doors with the FDA for rapid approval. He held a strong bargaining position given the political climate. But even that took too long for him, and he demanded special permission for Burroughs Wellcome to sell AZT while waiting for the official approval. FDA officials scrambled for an answer, dredging up a permit known as the treatment IND. This method had almost never been used. Within days, the technicalities were ironed out, and Berry had his permit to sell. Next, he had to get the official permission. He wanted it fast and based on less than scientific data than normally required. Again, the FDA complied, cutting the process down to several months. Even AZT studies on mice were dropped from the requirements. The final hurdle lay in a meeting of an advisory committee of scientists and doctors, whose recommendation would likely determine AZT's fate. The panel met for a single day in January of 1987. The dice were loaded in his favor, for 2 of the 11 panel members were paid consultants for Burroughs Wellcome. The FDA granted special permission for those 2 researchers to remain on the committee with full voting powers. Dozens of scientists from the Phase 2 trial showed up to argue their case, packing the room with virtual cheerleaders. They spent hour after hour flashing huge quantities of data past the committee, some of it so new that no one had had the time to review it beforehand. The follow-up results on the patients showing higher death rates after everyone went on AZT were cleverly buried in an avalanche of confusing statistics. Dazed, the members of the committee began to feel anxious that something had gone wrong in the testing process. Then Berry played his ace. A high-ranking FDA official, Paul Parkman, showed up and spoke, despite not having been scheduled to do so. After only a minute of suggesting most of the panel's concerns could be addressed, Parkman closed with a dramatic statement. "I think we can probably arrive at a plan that will satisfy people here." Suddenly, the argument stopped and the mood shifted from opposition to support for AZT. FDA officials had never before interfered in these meetings, and the entire committee was shocked. "Did you hear that?" the panel chairman said to an associate. "He's telling us to approve it." Few in the room knew that Parkman was a personal friend of Berry. They had once worked together on virology projects. The panel ended up recommending AZT, with only the chairman voting against it. Burroughs Wellcome quickly patented the drug, something no one else had ever bothered to do. The FDA endorsement could seem a cruel joke perpetuated by heartless AIDS scientists. Patients on AZT receive little more than white capsules surrounded by a blue band, but every time lab researchers order another batch for experimentation, they receive a bottle with a special label. A skull and crossbone symbol appears on a background of bright orange, signifying an unusual chemical hazard. The label appears on bottles containing as little as 25 milligrams of AZT, a small fraction, 1/20th to 1/50th of a patient's daily prescribed dose. The adjoining warning on the label reveals secrets not conveyed to the unwitting patient. Toxic by inhalation in contact with skin and if swallowed. Target organs, blood, bone, marrow. If you feel unwell, seek medical advice. Show the label where possible. Wear suitable protective clothing. DDI and other DNA chain terminators claim a piece of AZT's action. A different pharmaceutical giant, Bristol-Myers Squibb, produced another DNA chain terminator, DDI. The company sorely wanted to pull this drug off the shelf and into production, hoping to get a piece of the action from Burroughs' welcome. Sam Broder, after working in the mid-1980s to promote AZT, was only too happy to help along any such chemotherapy. He performed lab experiments on cultured cells, again, wrongly trying to argue that the drug blocked HIV production more effectively than it killed T cells. Bristol-Myers began sponsoring research on AIDS patients, but they performed no controlled study, never comparing DDL's effect to placebo in matched groups. The studies did, however, reveal a couple of additional toxic reactions not produced by AZT. It can cause fatal damage to the pancreas, and it can destroy nerves throughout the body. On an experimental basis, a number of doctors began giving DDL to thousands of AIDS patients who could not tolerate AZT. Hundreds of unexplained deaths occurred among these patients, but the FDA managed to quell growing concerns. The FDA Advisory Committee meeting to vote on DDL's approval convened in July 1991. On that day, the panel reviewed the sloppily gathered data on the drug, which was compared to unmatched and untreated AIDS patients from years earlier. On this questionable basis, the committee was told DDL worked as well as AZT. Given the astonishing lack of a controlled study, the panel leaned against approval. That is, until FDA Director David Kessler personally intervened on behalf of DDL and pressured the committee to be creative. The members changed their minds, voting to license the drug, albeit with restrictions. Doctors could prescribe it only for patients they felt did not benefit from AZT, leaving DDL as a secondary treatment and the second drug ever to win fast-track FDA approval. But even 4 years after its approval for human consumption, Anthony Fauci, director for AIDS research at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, stated to the New York Times, DDL had never been compared with a placebo in a large study. Since that time, the AIDS establishment has backed yet another DNA chain-terminating chemotherapies, including didioxycytidine, DDC, a drug also developed by Jerome Horowitz in the 1960s and now marketed by Hoffman LaRoche. The FDA has approved DDC, but only for use in combination with AZT or DDL.